G3. The Model of Being and Its Universal Laws. Number 17A.
We started out this morning with a concept of dimensionalism, and we have already touched on some of the main points. In dimensionalism, we see that this is the answer to the one-dimensional thinking, which was the ordinary way of logical reasoning. That's why the two-valued logic was adapted to such a reasoning, whereas the moment we come to the insight that reality is multidimensional, everything begins to change. We call that one-dimensional thinking reductionism. So I'm going to talk a little bit about reductionism. So the term dimensionalism is opposed to reductionism. These are terms that have come into the scientific language of today since the middle of the 1960s, especially, I think, when there was that Alpbach symposium. Alpbach is a nice, wonderful little village in the Austrian Alps, where Arthur Koestler, whom you certainly know as an author, he was an author that had the ability really to take all the new insights into the sciences and reduce them to the human language so that it could be explained to the man in the street. And in that Alpbach symposium, there we had many of the foremost thinkers in the new science, and that whole symposium was under that big subject, dimensionalism, reductionism. In English, the title of the book is Against Reductionism. So even if you don't find the term in Webster or in any other old dictionary, it is a very common term and one that is very necessary and practical. What means really reductionism? Well, reductionism means that it is a method to attempt really to explain the multidimensional reality only on one level. See, to reduce the multiple levels to one level. It is really that where you put on your blinders. It's an attempt, therefore, to reduce those varied and complex subjects to just one level, which then had the further dangerous consequence, namely that then one was considering just that one level as the only important level. And that's really the danger. What it means, I am going to explain. So you see, first, theoretically, reductionism is that false method that takes a multidimensional subject and reduces it just to one level, to one dimension, and reasons out everything of that big subject just on that one dimension, and then says, and this is the important dimension. This is what it is all about. Therefore, the term or the rendering that is being coined for reductionism is a very simple one. It is that rendering, it is nothing but, and I explain it to you. So nothing but means that it is reduced to just but one thing. So for instance, and I take that example from Koestler's book, that he said, now what happens when various sciences consider, for instance, the human body. If the engineer considers the human body, he says, it is nothing but a combustion process, because it is transforming energy, matter into energy, feeding matter, transforming it into energy, and then the body works. So from the point of view of the engineer, if he has a reductionist approach to the human body, he says that human body is nothing but, can you now hear the nothing but, is nothing but a combustion process. If the chemist looks at that same human body, he says it is nothing but an oxidation process. If a biologist looks at the same human body, he says the human body is actually nothing but a complicated biological mechanism. And if a cybernetician looks at the human body, he says, well, the human body is nothing but a compound of many, many computers that are working in the body. Or if you ask a theologian, a real old classical scholarly theologian, he says, well, the human body is nothing but a sinner, it's nothing but a mortal. Can you see what reductionism does? It takes a terrific big subject like man or the human body and looks at it only from his specific standpoint of his specific science and reduces everything to that specific science and says, after all, it's nothing but what he knows about that human body. So the mistake that is being made is really this, that it mistakes a phenomena like the human body and takes it as an epiphenomenon. You say epiphenomena? Yeah, phenomenon. Do you know the term? No? Epiphenomena? Oh, gosh. You know what a phenomena is? Yeah. An epiphenomena is a side phenomena of a phenomena. Huh? You can say it's a side phenomena. Not the real phenomena, but a side phenomena. So instead of saying it is a phenomena called human body, the biologist says, no, it's only a complicated biological mechanism. That's an epiphenomena. Yes. Which you see is what has led over the last, especially 100 or 150 years, to specialization. In earlier times, a scientist was always a generalist. He always knew a lot about many scientists. When you look at the scientists of the 16th, 17th, 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, those scientists were usually many things. They were physicists, they were chemists, they were biologists, they were zoologists, they were botanists, they were philosophers. All at one, they were generalists. But little by little, the knowledge became so big that one single person couldn't anymore cover all the sciences. And therefore, they began to specialize themselves and said, all right, I'm only interested in physics. All right, I'm only interested in chemistry. I'm only interested in philosophy. I'm only interested. You see, that was the beginning of splitting up the whole into departments, in fragments. There the departmentalization began, the fragmentation began, the specialization began. So instead of being trying to stay a generalist, they became specialists. And so what reductionism really does is to drop away from a general holistic view of science and become a specialist, which can be best expressed, I don't know if you know the French, but these terms are used in the English language. You know, the English language also takes on foreign expression because they are so good, because these specialists are then termed the les terribles simplificateurs, the terrible simplificator. Doesn't sound so nice in English as it sounds in French. They are terrible. They are not just specialisator, but they are terrible because they break up the whole, and that is the terror of it. So we must see that we science has gone along a line of specialization, and that has broken up the holistic sense, that has brought in the departmentization and fragmentation of understanding, so that, for instance, man as a concept, that has been then looked at from different angles. So from a, say, biological level, man has just been considered to be a somatic phenomena. From, say, a psychological angle of man, he has just been considered as a psychological phenomena. Or from a social level, he has just been considered as a sociological phenomena. Now, what is man? Is he a sociological phenomena? Is he a biological phenomena? Is he a somatic phenomena? What is he? See, that is only a question of the terrible simplificateur. That's not the question of a holistic thinker. Therefore, we have a drive today where now in the world they have begun to see that that specialization is not the answer unless they bring all those specialization again together into a whole and see how they work together in a whole. So that, therefore, we hear all over the place always that we now must have a dimensional sense of a subject, so that there is a dimensional sense of man, for instance. So that though the somatic concept of man contradicts the psychological concept of man, and that again contradicts the sociological concept of man, they are seen to be no contradiction if they are seen in a dimensional or holistic sense. And so in this way we begin to take the next step, you see, again back to a holistic sense, so that what appears to be contradictory does not need to be contradictory. So that one identity like man can appear as a somatic phenomena, as a sociological phenomena, as a psychological phenomena, as a physiological phenomena, as an atomistic phenomena. But all these phenomena do not contradict each other, though they are different, because they are epiphenomen, epi-side phenomena. Epiphenomena of what? Of one whole man. So actually dimensionalism is that method that can resolve contradictions and show that things that seem to be contradictory do not need to be contradictory, that they can be complementary instead of contradictory, and therefore solve many paradoxes. And this is the point where we then in Christian Science began to think about the dimensional sense of science, because we could see so many paradoxes in the textbook as long as we read the textbook one-dimensionally. I come back to it. So in this way we begin to see that contradiction do not need to be contradiction, that man is one, that we have to do only with one concept, a holistic concept, so that there is a variety in unity. Again, the great question, the one that is many, a variety in unity, so that this contradiction do not contradict the unity of man, that there is a whole sense of man, man as a multifarious unity, a multifarious aspects of one unity. So today, more and more in every science, you hear the term holistic, that medicine should be a holistic medicine. Have you heard of it? That we should have not just a material medicine or a psychological medicine, not even a psychosomatic, which already is a combination medicine, but that really medicine should be holistic. It should take in the whole man from every angle. And that only a real treatment would be if you would treat man holistically. Or you have heard, I'm quite sure, about holistic psychology, that all the various aspects of psychology can be united and should be united into one holistic psychology, and so on. So we have a whole trend back from really reductionism to a dimensional, which is at the same time a holistic sense of things. I have a feeling that I made that clear. Yes. Now, I would like to talk a little bit about dimensionalism, because we have been brought up in a universe since thousands and thousands of years of tradition, which accepts that the universe has three dimensions. We cannot think in any more dimensions than three dimensions, namely line, plane, space. Within that space, everything happens. And we can't think of a fourth, fifth, sixth, etc. dimension. But we know already, but only theoretically, that Einstein introduced about 80 years ago, a fourth dimension, and said there is another dimension, time, and so there is a four-dimensional universe, a space-time universe, and none of us can image fourth, can have an image, can have, make himself a picture of a four-dimensional universe. I don't think there is here somebody who can do it. So you see, we are up against a very difficult problem, that fundamentally we know that the three-dimensional universe is not the real universe, that with that sense we cannot explain the universe, that at least Einstein needed a fourth dimension in order to explain it, and we are at that position where we say, oh, I can't see that. Such a thing as a four-dimensional universe doesn't exist. I think Einstein was a fool. He was just thinking about very funny things. I think he should be put into an insane sanatorium or something like that. There are not four dimensions. It's impossible. I think we should really put him into a sanatorium, into a clinic. Don't you think so? Because he says something nobody understands and nobody can experience. And yet the whole development in the physical realm could only evolve because he was right. Now, we come up again, up against a very difficulty. How many dimensions should we have? How many dimensions has infinity? That's a good question. Has infinity only three dimensions? Can infinity be captured into a space, into a limited space of three dimensions? A good question. Don't you think so? Well, that question has been asked 100 years ago, quite an interesting man called Edwin Abbott. And he was perhaps one of the first that wrote science fiction, a little book called Flatland. And at the time he wrote Flatland, it was a fiction. And he hadn't the faintest idea that his fiction could once become reality. And therefore his little booklet of Flatland was read by a few, but was forgotten for a long time. And only really round about the 1930s, round about that time, it was again rediscovered. I only came across it in the late 1960s at a conference in Asilomar. Somebody in the audience talked to me about it, and I said, oh, that's interesting. What is his science fiction story? And I think if we understand that, we understand why we are forced to be willing to think in dimensions. He was showing, now I don't tell the whole story, I tell it in my language and abbreviated and a bit perhaps with my illustrations and flowering it with my words. Well, anyway, he was talking about Flatlanders. He said, well, think about a world where there are only two dimensions, like a worm. A worm more or less has only two dimensions in which he lives. He crawls along the earth and he has only right and left, forwards and backwards. It's always a two-dimensional universe, more or less, that worm lives in. And so he said, let's figure out, we have a land where the inhabitants are of the flat landers. They only know two dimensions. And they are very happy there, and they feel that's their universe and that's reality. And then one day some of the flatlanders had the funny idea to go upward to a third dimension. Instead of line and plane, to go upward, which would give a space to the three-dimensional universe. And suddenly going upward, he could see that he would recognize the flatland from a very different vantage point, that suddenly his land, his flatland, looked very different than what he was knowing, that from a higher standpoint he could see a completely different universe, and so he began to experience really the space land. So he became a space lander. And he was so happy about it that he said, I must go back to my brethren in Flatland and tell them about it. So he went back to Flatland and said, you know, you are all wrong. You think there are only Flatlanders, but there exists also Spacelanders. You can live in a Spaceland. So they were so infuriated that they put him into an insane clinic. See. Now, to make the story very short, we live in a three-dimensional, we are Spacelander, and haven't the faintest idea that there is another universe, that if there is a four-dimensional universe, like Einstein showed. But Einstein showed that 80 years ago. When you read the Paul Davies, his newest book, which he has brought out, he will tell you that actually today we can only explain reality with at least 11 dimensions, with 4 space-time dimensions and 7 force dimensions. And with the 4 and the 7, which seem to be, from a numerological standpoint, quite nice for us, that reality is the 4 and the 7, that he could say we can only explain really reality on an 11-dimensional standpoint, or from a 10 space dimensional plus 1 time dimensional concept, which again gives 11. So can you see, mathematically they can already see reality as an 11 dimensional reality. Who from us can know what he's talking about? Nobody can. We can't. It's just foreign to us. So actually we should take really Paul Davies, the physicist, and put him into an insane clinic, just because we can't understand it. But he can. He can on the basis of mathematics. So I only said this in order to show that we must free ourselves from that what only 100 years ago seemed to have been absolutely idiotic, namely that there is more than 3 dimensions, that there are many more dimensions, and in this way perhaps we also realize that also in Christian Science we should not always be thinking on a one-dimensional linear way, but that we should be aware that there may be a possibility that the textbook is written in a multi-dimensional way.